All right. So this is the second time I'm recording this episode in full. So today I'm doing the second part to the Sylvia Likens case. And I've got a big part two for y'all. I'm covering pretty much the rest of the entire case from the escalation of the abuse to the arrest and the trials and all that stuff that happened afterwards. It's a lot. So just stay with me here, because I feel like this is going to be very important. And the reason why I personally, right now, I'm just realizing why I kind of want to do more cases like this, because not only because I can relate to this case to some degree, it is a big important value or topic that is child abuse, child neglect, that I think needs to be covered more. So I will get into this story now. As I mentioned before, both sisters were afraid of telling any of their family about the abuse they were enduring at the hands of Gertrude. They were fearful that doing so would only make it worse. This was more of a struggle for Jenny, because Gertrude had threatened her that if she told any of her family members, she would be subjected to the same amount of torture that was being inflicted onto her sister Sylvia. Jenny was also being bullied at school on top of being beaten any time she would even allude to the abuse that was happening at the hands of Gertrude. In July and August, Lester and Elizabeth Likens would return to Indianapolis to visit their daughters on occasion. That is, when they could afford to do so. The last time they visited their daughters was on October 5th, and neither Jenny or Sylvia showed signs of distress. At least, none that were visible to their parents. This could possibly be because Gertrude and her children were present at this time. After their parents left, the Banaszewskis turned to Sylvia and said, "What are you going to do now, Sylvia? Now they're gone." On one occasion, the girls actually ran into their older sister, Diana Schumacher, or Shoemaker, I think is how you say that. I could be wrong, however. They expressed the abuse they were enduring, specifically mentioning how Sylvia was receiving most of the physical abuse. This was almost done in accusation. This was almost done in accusation of the things they had never even done nor said. I myself had also suffered abuse. This was at the hands of my stepmother. I would be accused of breaking my personal belongings. Of course, this is just what I'm speculating, as this was never done to my face. Neither of the girls mentioned the address of where they were currently staying. Diana had initially thought that the abuse story from her sisters was exaggerated. They had encountered Diana several weeks prior to this event in the company of 11-year-old Marie Banaszewski. Diana gave Sylvia a sandwich to eat after she mentioned she was hungry. While Sylvia kept silent about it, Marie told her family of this. Gertrude then went on to accuse Sylvia of gluttony. This was followed by Gertrude and Paula beating and bludgeoning her. Likens was subjected by the pair to a scalding bath. This was to cleanse her of sin. And Gertrude would grab Sylvia's hair and bang her head against the bath to revive her when she fainted. After this incident, a father of one of the neighborhood boys named Michael John Monroe had reported to Arsenal Technical High School anonymously that one of the girls residing in the Banaszewski household had open sores on her body. Likens had not been seen at school for several days, so the school nurse went to investigate these claims. Gertrude would tell the nurse that Sylvia had run away from her house the week before, saying that she had no idea of the girl's whereabouts at the time. She had said the open sores were due to Sylvia's lack of personal hygiene, and that she was out of control. Gertrude later claimed that Likens was a bad influence on both her own children and her sister. The school did no further investigation into the welfare of Sylvia Likens. The immediate neighbors of the Banaszewskis, a middle-aged couple named Raymond and Phyllis Vermillion, had initially viewed Gertrude as an ideal caregiver for both Jenny and Sylvia, and had visited the house twice while they were under Gertrude's care. It was on both occasions that the Vermillions would witness Paula abusing Sylvia, who had a black eye on both occasions, and openly boasted about the mistreatment of the girl to the couple. With that being said, the Vermillions never reported the mistreatment to the authorities. It was either on October 1st that Diana would discover that her sisters were staying at the Banaszewski residence, approached the property to initiate regular contact, but was denied entry by Gertrude, saying that she was given permission by their parents to deny contact to both of the girls. Diana encountered Jenny near the house by chance. When she asked about Sylvia's welfare, Jenny said, "I can't tell you, or I'll get in trouble." An increase in the and the abuse and torture of Sylvia would result in her becoming incontinent. Incontinent is the word. Which means she would have an uncontrolled leakage of urine. She was denied any sort of access to a bathroom and would then be forced to wet herself. Gertrude would punish Lykins for this. One such example of a punishment was on October 6th. Sylvia wet herself, so Gertrude tied her up and threw her into the basement. Whenever this would happen, she would usually be naked, often left unfed, and deprived of water. Sometimes she would even be tied up to the railing of the basement stairs, so her feet would barely touch the ground. In the weeks leading up to this, Lykins would be increasingly abusive. Lykins would be increasingly abused and tormented by Gertrude. She would often say that Lykins had insulted her or her children directly. Such claims were false. In order to provoke the children into attacking or belting Lykins, one incident would include Gertrude holding a knife, saying, "Fight me back," to which Lykins had replied by saying that she did not know how to fight. In response to this, Gertrude would produce a light wound to Lykins' leg. Abuse like this would occasionally pause if the Banaszewskis were watching their favorite television shows, or neighborhood children would also pay, or things like that. Neighborhood children would also pay 5 cents to view Lykins, as well as humiliate, beat, scald, burn, and mutilate her. Throughout this time, Lykins would often be restrained and gagged by Gertrude with the help of her own children, the neighborhood children, and place her into a bath of scalding water and rub salt into her wounds. On another occasion, Gertrude took the urine and feces from her one-year-old son and rubbed this into Lykins' mouth. She then gave Lykins a half-filled cup of water, stating that this would be all the water Lykins would be receiving for the day. On October 22nd, John Banaszewski Jr. tormented Lykins by allowing her to eat a bowl of soup with her fingers, but immediately taking the bowl away from her when Lykins would attempt to eat the food. Gertrude eventually allowed Lykins to sleep upstairs on the condition that she learned how to not wet herself. That night, Sylvia whispered to her sister, Jenny, to give her a glass of water in secret before going to sleep. The next morning, Gertrude discovered that Lykins had urinated on herself. As a punishment, Sylvia was forced to insert a Coca-Cola bottle into her nether regions in the presence of the Banaszewski children before Gertrude forced her to go back into the basement. This part of the story I can sort of relate to, mostly the restriction of water due to a UTI that I had contracted. I also had an issue with wetting the bed. Of course, my biological father and his wife wouldn't believe that, and blamed me because I was apparently wetting the bed on purpose. This would result in me being forced to wear a diaper when I slept and doing chores to pay for the mattress that I had ruined, according to my biological father and his wife. Emotional stress caused by traumatic events or disruptions in your normal routine can cause bed wetting. For example, moving to a new home, enrolling in a new school, the death of a loved one, or sexual abuse may cause bed wetting episodes. This is a quote from the Cleveland Clinic website. Well, on this specific site, this fact is under the causes of bedwetting in adults. I was around 11 years old at the time. So yeah, that is a personal anecdote from my life that I could relate to. Except again, mine was I had a urinary tract infection. I won't be secretive about that. even though it is embarrassing. But I do remember being told by my mother that a kid at the age that I was, that is beyond the age of potty training and stuff like that, if they wet the bed, it can be a sign of child abuse. So, yeah. Shortly after this, Gertrude shouted for Lykins to return to the kitchen, where she would force Lykins to strip naked, stating, "You have branded my daughters, now I'm going to brand you." Then proceeded to carve, "I am a prostitute and proud of it," into Lykins's abdomen with a heated needle. She was unable to finish, however, instructing 14-year-old Richard Dean Hobbs to finish it for her. While this was happening, Gertrude would take Jenny to a nearby grocery store. Hobbs would insist that these etchings were short and light. This was whilst Lykins was moaning and clenching her teeth in pain. Then both Richard Hobbs and Shirley Banaszewski led Sylvia Lykins down to the basement, where they would use anchor bolts, a piece of equipment used to connect structural and non-structural elements to concrete, to attempt to burn the letter S into Sylvia's left breast. They, however, produced one section of the loop backwards, making the S look like the number 3 instead. Gertrude taunted Sylvia by stating that she would never be able to marry due to the words that were carved onto her abdomen. "Sylvia, what are you going to do now? You can't get married now. What are you going to do?" is what she said. To which Lykins replied whilst crying, "I guess there's nothing I can do." Later that day, Lykins was forced to display the etchings to the neighborhood children, while Gertrude claimed she received it at a sex party, which is a sexual behavior involving more than two people, usually a group of people. This group can be of any sexual or gender orientation. And I have to say, those types of parties are not always bad. It's more depending on if it's consensual to, on, like, for all individuals involved. That same night, Sylvia would say to her sister, Jenny, "I know you don't want me to die, but I'm going to die. I can tell it." Gertrude would then wake Sylvia the next day and force her to write a letter to her parents. The contents of the letter were intended to mislead Sylvia's parents into believing she had run away from Gertrude's home. She was forced to write that she was extensively abused and mutilated by a group of boys after she had agreed to have sexual relations with an anonymous group of boys. After this, the abuse and torture was inflicted upon Sylvia's body. After this letter was written, Gertrude formulated the rest of her diabolical plan. This letter seems to be an attempt to remove Gertrude as the cause of the wounds left on Sylvia's body completely. And not only this, but also tarnished Sylvia's reputation in the process. Gertrude's plan was to have Jenny and John Jr. blindfold Sylvia, then take her to Jimmy's Forest, which was a wooded area nearby, and leave Sylvia there to die. After finishing the letter, Sylvia was again tied up to the stair railing in the basement and offered crackers to eat. But Sylvia refused, saying, give it to the dog. I don't want it." This was followed by Gertrude forcing the crackers into Lykins's mouth, then had John Jr. beat Sylvia around the stomach. On October 25th, Sylvia would attempt an escape after overhearing Gertrude's plan to abandon her and leave her to die in the woods. She attempted to flee through the front door, but Gertrude caught her before she could leave the property. Sylvia was also given some crackers, but due to dehydration, couldn't consume the food. So Gertrude forced the crackers into her mouth and beat her with a curtain rod. She beat the girl's face until the sections of the curtain rod were bent into right angles. Coy Hubbard then took the curtain rod from Gertrude and started hitting Sylvia, that is. This knocked Sylvia unconscious. Gertrude dragged Sylvia's body into the basement while she was unconscious. That evening, Likens would attempt to alert the neighbors by screaming and hitting the walls of the basement with a spade, which a neighbor would report later that they heard desperate commotion coming from the Banaszewski house. She identified that the source of the noise was indeed coming from the basement, but didn't notify police because the noise ceased at 3 a.m. On October 6th, Sylvia Likens was unable to speak intelligibly or correctly coordinate the movement of her limbs. Gertrude moved Likens into the kitchen and propped her up against the wall, attempting to feed her a donut and milk. Out of frustration, Gertrude threw Likens to the floor because she was unable to correctly move the glass toward her lips. Gertrude then returned her to the basement. Shortly after this, Likens became delirious, repeatedly moaning and mumbling. When Paula asked her to recite the English alphabet, Sylvia was only able to recite the first four letters. She couldn't even raise herself off the ground. Paula would then threaten Likens by saying she would long jump on her if she didn't stand up. Gertrude then ordered her to clean herself up, seeing as Sylvia had defecated on herself. That afternoon, several of Likens' other tormentors gathered in the basement. Likens jerkily moved her arm, pointing towards her tormentors' faces, saying things such as, "You're Ricky, and you're Gertie." This is when Gertrude shouted, "Shut up! You know who I am!" Later on, Sylvia would unsuccessfully attempt to bite into a rotten pear that she'd been given to eat. She said she could feel the looseness in her teeth. When Jenny heard this, she replied, "Don't you remember, Sylvia? Your front tooth was knocked out when you were seven." Oh, my mic fell. Jenny then left Sylvia to do gardening chores for the neighbors in hopes of earning spending money. In an attempt to clean Likens, John Jr. hosed down Likens with a hose that Randy Lepper brought at the request of Gertrude. Likens again attempted to exit the basement but collapsed before she could even reach the stairs. In response, Gertrude stamped on her head and then proceeded to stare at her for several moments. After 5:30 p.m., Richard Hobbs returned to the Banaszewski household, slipping on the wet basement stairs, falling heavily. He was confronted with the sight of Stephanie crying and cuddling the emaciated and lacerated body. This was after Stephanie had been ordered by her mother to clean Sylvia. Richard and Stephanie decided to give Likens a warm, soapy bath. They dressed her in new clothes and laid her on the mattress of one of the bedrooms. Then Sylvia would mutter her last words, wishing that her daddy was here, and that Stephanie would take her home. Stephanie then turned to her younger sister, Shirley, and exclaimed, "Oh, she'll be all right." When Stephanie realized that Sylvia wasn't breathing, she began to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Stephanie had also shouted to the other children in the house that Sylvia was faking her death. Sylvia Likens died at the age of 16 due to the injuries caused by her tormentors. Gertrude did not believe that Sylvia was dead. Initially,
She repeatedly beat Sylvia's corpse with a book, shouting, "Faker! Faker!" in an attempt to rouse her. Perhaps realizing that Sylvia was actually dead, she became panicked and told Richard Hobbs to call the police from a nearby payphone. Police arrived at the house at approximately 6:30 p.m. Gertrude led them to the emaciated, bludgeoned, and absolutely mutilated body of Sylvia Likens. Gertrude handed the police the note that Sylvia had written under her dictation, and told the police she had been doctoring Sylvia's wounds for an hour or more before she died. She said she applied rubbing alcohol in a futile attempt at first aid. She added the false story of Likens running away with a group of teenage boys and returned bare-breasted and clutching the note. Paula Banaszewski, while clutching a Bible, said that Sylvia's death was meant to happen, then glanced toward Jenny and stated, "If you want to live with us, Jenny, we'll treat you like our own sister." Of course, prior to the police's arrival, Jenny was instructed to tell them a false version of what had occurred. Jenny whispered to the officers, "You get me out of here, and I'll tell you everything." This led to an official statement from Jenny causing the officers to arrest Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, and John Banaszewski Jr. on the suspicions of Likens' murder within hours of discovering Likens' body. On that same day, Coy Hubbard and Richard Hobbs were also arrested on the same charges. The three eldest Banaszewski children, as well as Coy Hubbard, were placed in the custody of a juvenile detention center. The youngest Banaszewski children and Richard Hobbs were detained at the Indianapolis Children's Guardian's home. All of them were held without bail, pending trial. Gertrude would initially deny any involvement, but did state that on October 27th, she confessed to knowing that Paula and Coy had physically and emotionally abused Sylvia Likens. She stated, "Paula did most of the damage, and Coy did most of the beating." Gertrude did admit to forcing Likens to sleep in the basement on three occasions when she wet the bed. Gertrude did become evasive when the officers mentioned the reason why Likens had become incontinent was likely due to her mental distress and damage to her kidneys. Meanwhile, Paula, lacking any remorse, signed a statement admitting that she had repeatedly beaten Likens on her backside with her mother's police belt, breaking her wrists on Likens' jaw, and committing other brutality acts. This would include pushing her down the stairs into the basement two or three times, according to Paula, then giving Likens a black eye. John Jr. admitted to having spanked Sylvia. He added to this that most of the time I used my fists to abuse her. He also admitted to burning Sylvia on several occasions with matches, and added that his mother also burnt her with cigarettes. The other five children who participated in Likens' abuse and torture, Michael Monroe, Randy Lepper, Darlene McGuire, Judy Duke, and Anna Sisko, were arrested on October 29th, being charged with causing injury to person. Each was released to the custody of their parents under subpoena, meaning that they'd appear as witnesses in the upcoming trial. The autopsy conducted by Dr. Arthur Kebble would reveal that Likens had around 150 separate wounds across her entire body. She was also noticeably emaciated at the time of her death. The wounds varied in location, severity, and stages of healing. The injuries included severe muscle bruising, burns, extensive muscle damage, and extensive nerve damage. Her vaginal cavity had been practically swollen shut. All of Likens' nails were broken backwards, and the external layers on her face, neck, breasts, and right knee had peeled or receded. In the throes of death, it was also noted that lichens may have bitten through her lip, severing sections of it from her face. Her cause of death was listed as a subdural hematoma, which is a type of bleeding that occurs in the brain. This was caused due to multiple blows to her right temple. The contributing factors to her death were listed as severe damage inflicted to her skin, hypodermis, and severe malnutrition. Rigor mortis, the fourth stage of death, was well set by the time they discovered the body. This indicated that lichens may have been dead for up to 8 hours before they arrived. One thing that wasn't noted is that lichens' body had been bathed after her death, which could have hastened the loss of body temperature, thus hastening the onset of rigor mortis. Sylvia Lichens' funeral was held on the afternoon of October 29th. The funeral was officiated by Reverend Louis Gibson and attended by over 100 mourners. It was an open casket, gray in color, adorned by a portrait made of her prior to July 1965. In his eulogy, Reverend Gibson said, "We all have our time, but we won't suffer like our little sister suffered during the last days of her life." The Reverend added, as he strode toward her casket, "She is gone for eternity." She was then buried in Oak Hill Cemetery with the words, "Our darling daughter," inscribed on her tombstone. On December 30th, 1965, Gertrude Banaszewski had been indicted for first-degree murder. This is more so a formal accusation than a sentence, meaning she wasn't officially convicted of it. Two of her three eldest children, Paula and John Jr., were also indicted. Along with these three, Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard were also indicted. All of them were charged with repeatedly striking, beating, kicking, and otherwise inflicting several fatal injuries to Sylvia Lichens with premeditated malice. 3 weeks prior, Stephanie Banaszewski had been released on writ of habeas corpus. I think I'm butchering that a little bit. This challenges a person's reasons or conditions for confinement under law. Her attorney had successfully contended that there was no sufficient evidence that stated Stephanie had any part in the murder or culmination of injuries that were inflicted on Sylvia Lichens. She waived her immunity from potential impending prosecution, but did agree to testify against her family and other individuals charged with the abuse and murder of Sylvia Lichens. As a pretrial, several psychiatrists testified before Judge Saul Isaac Rabb on March 16, 1966, pertaining to their conclusions regarding psychiatric evaluations they conducted upon the individuals charged, which yielded that all three were mentally fit to stand trial. Trial of Gertrude Banaszewski, her children, Paula and John Jr., Richard Hobbs, and Coy Hubbard, began on April 18, 1966. They were all tried together before Judge Rabb in the Indianapolis City County Building. The initial jury selection had begun on this day and continued for several days. The prosecution, consisting of Leroy K. New and Marjorie Wessner, announced their intention to seek the death penalty for all five defendants on April 16th. They had also argued successfully before Judge Rabb that all five defendants should be tried together, as they were ultimately charged with acting in concert in their crimes against Lichens.
If they were each tried separately, neither judge nor jury would hear a testimony relating to the entire situation of the accumulation of the offenses. Each juror was questioned by counsels for prosecution and defense regarding their opinion about capital punishment being a just penalty for first-degree murder. They also counseled for the jurors' opinion on whether a mother was responsible for the deportment of her children. Each of the jurors opposed the death penalty were excused from duty by Leroy New. Any juror who worked with children expressed prejudice to an insanity defense or repulsion regarding the actual nature of Likens's death was excused by the defense counsel. Gertrude Banaszewski would be defended by William Erbacher, Paula defended by Georgia Rice, Richard Hobbs was defended by James G. Netter, John Jr., Coy Hubbard were defended by Forrest Bowman. The attorneys of Paula, John Jr., Coy Hubbard, and Richard Hobbs claimed their clients were pressured into participating in the torture of Likens. Gertrude herself pled not guilty by reason of insanity. One of the witnesses that testified on behalf of the prosecution was Coroner Charles Ellis. He testified that on April 29th, to the intense pain Likens had suffered, he mentioned that her fingernails had been broken. One of the witnesses that testified on behalf of prosecution was Charles Ellis. He testified on April 29th to the intense pain Likens had suffered. He mentioned that her fingernails had been broken backwards. There were numerous cuts and punctures and that her lips were essentially shreds. Ellis also stated that Likens had been in a state of shock for 2 or 3 days prior to her death, and that she likely was in a too advanced state to resist any form of torture in her final hours. He also emphasized that aside from the extensive damage caused to her genitals, her body bore no direct evidence of sexual molestation. On May 22nd and 23rd, Jenny would testify against all of the defendants, stating all of them had repeatedly, extensively, physically, and emotionally abused her sister. She added that her sister had done nothing to provoke the abuse from any of the defendants, that there was no truth in any of the rumors she'd been accused of spreading, that they made up that went against Sylvia's character. Throughout her testimony, Jenny stated the abuse towards her sister and to lesser extent herself had begun 2 weeks after staying in the Banaszewski's home. Jenny also mentioned that the abuse escalated. Likens was unable to produce tears due to dehydration. Jenny then burst into tears upon recalling what her sister had said to her. I'm just trying to scroll here, it's taken a while. Just days before she had passed. Parts of Jenny's statements were corroborated by Randy Lepper. He stated that he had witnessed Likens cry, but that no actual tears were shed. Lepper also said that he'd witnessed Stephanie strike Likens real hard after Likens had been ordered to remove her clothes in his presence. He then smirked and confessed to having beaten Likens on 10 to 40 separate instances. On May 10th, Baptist minister Roy Julian testified that he had known a child in the Banaszewski house was being abused. He failed to report this because Gertrude had told him that Likens was making advances on men for money. He thought the girl was being punished for soliciting. Judy Duke, who was 13 years old, testified to witnessing Likens having salt rubbed in her wounds on her leg until she screamed. She also testified she witnessed 10-year-old Shirley Banaszewski rip open Sylvia's blouse, to which Richard Hobbs made the casual remark, "Everybody's having fun with Sylvia." Gertrude testified in her own defense the following day. She denied responsibility for any of the abuse, torment, and ultimate death inflicted upon Likens. She stated that her children and other neighborhood children had committed the acts within her home. She described her house as being such a madhouse. She said she'd been too preoccupied with her own ill health and depression to control her children, and said she'd started to spank Likens on one occasion, but was emotionally unable to finish doing so. She said that she had not hit Likens on any further occasion, denied having any knowledge of Likens being beaten, scalded, branded, or burned within her home. This was, however, testified against 2 days later by Richard Hobbs, who testified that Gertrude had him finish etching, "I am a prostitute and proud of it," into Sylvia's abdomen. He also testified that he had known of Gertrude's plan by informing him that Sylvia wouldn't be at the Banaszewski home on October 26th, that Gertrude had planned to get rid of Sylvia. He stated that after Likens' death, he went back to watching the rest of the Lloyd Thaxton show. When Marie Banaszewski testified, she broke down and confessed to heating the needle that Hobbs used to brand Sylvia. She testified to her mother's indifference towards Likens' evident distress when it came to the physical and emotional abuse. She stated on one occasion that Gertrude also mentioned. She stated on one occasion that although 5 defendants stood trial, she mostly witnessed her mother and sister, who I am assuming would be Paula in this case, commit the acts of most of the time. Grace Sargent was another witness that testified in this trial. She stated that she had sat close to Paula on a church bus and had overheard her openly bragging about how she broke her own wrist beating Sylvia Likens, ending her boast with, "I tried to kill her." On May 16th, a court-appointed doctor, Dwight Schuster, was questioned by Leroy New about the exhaustive interviews and assessments he'd conducted with Gertrude, to which Schuster stated that she'd been uncooperative and evasive. He testified that he believed Gertrude to be fully sane and fully in control of her actions. She was fully sane in October of 1965 and is fully sane up to this date, is what he'd add. The trials lasted a total of 17 days before the jury retired to consider its verdict. On May 19th, 1966, after deliberating for 8 hours, the panel of 8 men and 4 women found Gertrude Banaszewski guilty of first-degree murder and recommended a life imprisonment sentence. Paula Banaszewski was found guilty of second-degree murder. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banaszewski Jr. were found guilty of manslaughter. The Banaszewskis burst into tears, attempting to console one another, while Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard remained impassive. On May 25th, Gertrude and Paula were sentenced to life in prison. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banaszewski Jr. were sentenced to 2 to 21 years in Indianapolis Reformatory. In September 1970, this sentence of life imprisonment was overturned by the Indiana Supreme Court on the basis that Judge Rabb had denied repeatedly submitted motions by their defense counsel at the original trial. The motion was for a change of venue and separate trials. This ruling stated that the circumstances regarding a prejudicial atmosphere created during the initial trial due to extensive publicity and media coverage impeded the chance of either appellant receiving a fair trial. In 1971, Paula and Gertrude were retried for the same charges. Paula opted to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter rather than face retrial. She was sentenced between 2 to 21 years for the murder and abuse of Sylvia Likens. Despite two unsuccessful attempts at escaping prison, Paula was released in December of 1972. Gertrude, on the other hand, was once again convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Over the course of 14 years, Gertrude became known as a model prisoner. She worked in the prison sewing shop and was known as some sort of den mother to the younger female inmates. By the time she was paroled in 1985, she'd changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen. This was a combination of her middle name and maiden name, and I will be using Gertrude and Nadine interchangeably from this point on. News of Nadine's impending parole made an uproar throughout Indianapolis. Jenny Likens, along with other close members of the Likens family, protested her release. The members of two anti-crime groups also traveled to Indiana to oppose the potential parole of Nadine Van Fossen. They openly supported the Likens family. The members of the group also initiated a sidewalk picket campaign, and over the course of 2 months gained the signature of 40,000 citizens of Indiana. This included signatures from outraged citizens who were too young to remember the case, demanding that Gertrude Banaszewski, a.k.a. Nadine Van Fossen, remain incarcerated for the remainder of her life. In her parole hearing, Gertrude stated that she wished Sylvia Likens' death could be undone. Although she minimized her role in Sylvia's death in the initial trial, she stated, "I'm not sure what role I had in Likens' death, because I was on drugs. I never really knew her. I take full responsibility for whatever happened to Sylvia." The panel took this as well as Gertrude's alleged good behavior while in prison into account and voted in her favor. Gertrude was released from prison on December 4th, 1985. Gertrude relocated to Iowa after being released. She never really took full responsibility for the abuse and torment. She insisted that she was unable to recall precisely any of her actions in the months that the abuse and torment occurred in her home. She blamed her actions on the medication she had been prescribed for her asthma. Nadine would live in relative obscurity until her death in Laurel, Iowa, June 16th, 1990, of lung cancer. Upon her death, the issue of Gertrude's sanity at both trials was raised. A reporter of the Indianapolis Star, John Dean, provided a lot of coverage over the case. He stated in 2015, "I never thought she was insane. I thought she was a downtrodden, mean woman." Dean also likened the case to Lord of the Flies by William Golding. He stated that although the increase of the abuse and torture of Likens from the children was not a result of children going wild, it was a result of children doing what they are told. As for Gertrude's motive for murder, attorney Forrest Bowman stated in 2014, "She had a miserable life. What I think was ultimately what this was ultimately about was jealousy." Paula Banaszewski also assumed a new identity, working as an aide to a school counselor for 14 years at Beeman Conrad Liscomb Union Witten Community School in Conrad, Iowa. That's a mouthful to say. She concealed her identity by changing her name to Paula Pace, but was fired in 2012 when her true identity was discovered. She got married and had two children. The daughter she'd given birth to upon awaiting trial in 1966 was named after Paula's mother. This baby was later adopted. Stephanie Banaszewski would also change her name. She became a school teacher, got married, and had several children. She was last known to have resided in Florida. After the arrest of their mother, Marie, Shirley, and James were placed in the care of foster families. Their surnames were legally changed to Blake in the late 1960s after their father legally regained custody. Marie would later marry and die of natural causes on June 8, 2017. Dennis Lee Wright was adopted. His adopted mother renamed him Denny Lee White. He died February 5, 2012. As for Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Vanazewski Jr., they were released on parole on February 27, 1968. Richard Hobbs died of lung cancer on January 2, 1972. He suffered at least one nervous breakdown in the years after he was released. Coy Hubbard remained in Indiana after his release. He was repeatedly imprisoned throughout his adult life for various offenses. He was charged on one occasion with the 1977 murder of two young men. He was acquitted of the charges. After the premiere of An American Crime in January 2007, Hubbard was fired from his job. He died of a heart attack in Shelbyville, Indiana, on June 23rd of that same year. John Vanazewski Jr. lived under relative obscurity, going by the name of John Blake. He became a lay minister, this means in a religious organization that he wasn't part of the clergy, but was an unordained minister, so to speak. He frequently hosted counseling sessions for children with divorced parents. Decades after his release, he released a statement saying that he and his co-defendants should have received a more severe punishment. The charges against the other juveniles in this case were dropped. Ann Sisko died October 23, 1996, and Randy Lepper died on November 14, 2010. Jenny Likens later married a man named Leonard Reese Wade. They had two children together. Jenny remained traumatized by what she'd witnessed her sister endure. Jenny was dependent on anxiety medications for the remainder of her life. She died of a heart attack on June 23, 2004, in Beech Grove, Indiana. 14 years before her own death, Jenny viewed the obituary of Gertrude Vanazewski and sent the clipping along with a note to her mother. The note said, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I'm happy about that." Elizabeth and Lester Likens died in 1998 and 2013, respectively. In the years before her own death, Jenny emphasized that there should be no blame placed upon her parents for placing her and Sylvia in the care of Gertrude Vanazewski. And I agree with her on that. All her parents did was trust Gertrude to take care of their daughters, and that trust had been betrayed. The house in which Sylvia Likens had been tortured and died in, 3850 East New York Street, would remain vacant for many years after her death and the arrest of her tormentors. The property gradually became dilapidated, and discussions were held of possibly purchasing the house, rehabilitating it, and converting it into a woman's shelter, but the necessary funds to do so were never raised. The house itself was demolished on April 23, 2009. It is now the site of a church parking lot. In June 2001, a 6-foot-tall granite memorial was formally dedicated to Sylvia Likens' life and legacy. This statue is in Willard Park, Washington Street, Indianapolis. The dedication was attended by several hundred people, including the members of the Likens family. The memorial was inscribed with these words: "This memorial is in memory of a young child who died a tragic death." As a result, laws changed and awareness increased. This is a commitment to our children that the Indianapolis Police Department is working to make this a safe city for our children. Sylvia's death is credited for the adoption of Indiana's mandated reporter law. The law states that a member of the public who suspects a child of abuse, child of being abused or neglected, has a legal obligation to report the suspected abuse to the authorities. On October 26, 2015, many civilians of Indianapolis, including Likens' older sister, Diana Bedwell, gathered in Lebanon, Indiana, to honor Sylvia Likens, to reflect upon her life upon the 50th anniversary of her death. Sorry for the long pause here. Just trying to get this to scroll if I can. Okay. To honor all children who lose their lives to child abuse, which as of 2020, according to usafacts.org, 2 per 100,000 children died of abuse or neglect. Diana informed those in attendance that Sylvia's legacy must always be remembered. Sylvia's tragic murder and abuse must always be remembered. Sylvia's Child Advocacy Center is officially dedicated to the memory of Sylvia Likens. It was founded in 2010 in Lebanon, Indiana. It was initially named Boone County Child Advocacy Program. It was renamed in Likens' honor in 2016. The most important thing we can do is tell kids they are hurt and we are listening. This was something no one did for young Sylvia. Her family is thankful, though it doesn't have to be that way anymore. She did not die in vain. She died a horrific death, but because of that, we are hoping that another child can be saved, the executive director said. This child advocacy program center works with was formed to assist child victims of abuse or neglect. It attempts to minimize the ongoing traumatic effects experienced as a result of their ordeal, to undertake a relentless pursuit to prevent child abuse in Boone and Montgomery counties. Professionals at Sylvia's Child Advocacy Center work with law enforcement and the local child services department. They also conduct forensic interviews and provide assistance in legal procedures, as well as mental and medical health referrals. This has been the Sylvia Likens case, malicious intent. And I want to say I feel a personal connection to this case just to some degree, and I would like to thank Sylvia's Child Advocacy Center for the work that they do, because of course children in the case of child abuse, they want to be heard. They want someone to say, "We are hurt. You are hurt, and we are here to help. We are here to listen. We believe you." And that is something that Sylvia, I agree, she never got that. her abuse went unnoticed, unreported by so many people. And in my own case, my abuse did not go unnoticed. It was not physical abuse, it was emotional abuse, it was verbal abuse to some extent, I suppose. And this stuff does take a toll on the individual that survives it. It has affected my mental health. It gave me PTSD, which I still probably suffer from to this day, to some degree. It really does affect the people, a lot of people. So to hear about an organization that's actively, that would have benefited me had I lived in, you know, Indiana or around the time that I was going through this, just to have, and I'm lucky that I did have someone with me who was, a bunch of people on my side who were listening, and that the abuse did not advance to physical abuse. But in the case of Sylvia Likens, that did happen. And it advanced seemingly pretty quickly. So my purpose of this episode was to spread awareness and hopefully let another child that's going through something like this, that they are not alone and that they can absolutely tell someone. And if you are a person who knows or suspects a child of being abused or neglected, report that. Report that shit, please. As always, have a great day, a great life, a great whatever. Stay safe, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time. Bye!